Okay. Good stuff. There was an older guy who decided that he wanted to adopt a child. It's quite a unique thing, adoption. We talked about it the other night. Some of you know about it from personal experience. The parent, by definition, chooses in a special way to love you, to make you one of their own. So he went into the orphanage. It was one of those old style ones that had baby cots all the way around the room. Dirty nappy smell lingered. And his eye fell on this particular child. It wasn't that this one was especially cute. The child was an ugly little rug rat, to be honest. But the man had decided that this was the one. And the reason this was such a special adoption was because it turned out that the kid was from a slave background and the father was a king. What an amazing turnaround in fortunes this child was about to enjoy. God the Father and Israel his son. It's what the whole Bible story is all about. A relationship between God and his people, his children. Out of Egypt I called my son. And there are ups and downs in the relationship, partly fueled by hostility out there, often because of wandering hearts in here. The one constant was the character of the Father, utterly faithful to his promises, even when he has to exile his children for their disobedience. God had bound himself permanently to Israel, his child, in such a way that every single thing that happened to them ultimately reflected back on him. Do you remember Exodus? I'm going to rescue you so that you know how great I am, but also so that Pharaoh and the whole earth will know that I'm the mighty Lord. And that's why what we read about yesterday was so shocking, because a plan to annihilate all Jews in one day, that's a plan to annihilate the people of God, a plan to annihilate the promises of God, and that means it was a plan to annihilate the very character of God. Do you know things about the Lord? Things you feel sure about, that you can trust about his character? Well, for his precious people to be completely wiped off the face of the earth, that would throw everything you think you know about God into doubt. So let's enjoy watching deliverance rise, as it surely will. Remember, that was the phrase Mordecai used when his cousin Esther, he assured her that relief and deliverance would arise, even after this grim annihilation order has been declared over them. And we left things on a bit of a cliffhanger. Esther had resolved to confront the king about Haman's plan. And it's a book of real turnarounds. It has so many levels and these extremes, because Mordecai, he's been on a journey. Remember telling Esther not to say that she was a Jew. End of chapter 4, instructing her to be bold and go to the king, risking her life. And actually, at the end of chapter 4, another sort of little turnaround in their relationship, from Esther being the one being instructed. End of chapter 4, it's Mordecai obeying Esther's instructions. So she really comes into her own at this point and becomes the key player. Esther hasn't mentioned to her husband yet that she is a Jew. It clearly didn't come up in their marriage preparation class. So 5 verse 1, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall, facing the entrance. Now that sounds harmless enough, but do you remember we heard in chapter 4, you can't just walk into the king of Persia without an appointment, even when you're his wife. And the incentive to stop people from doing that is you'll get executed if you try and sneak through to see him. It's quite an extreme way to avoid interruptions, but that's the routine, unless when you walk in, he graciously holds out this golden scepter. So Esther takes the risk, 5 verse 2. And at this point, the story becomes like one of those contraptions, you know, when a ball drops down a chute and that spins a wheel, which turns a pulley, and that sends a domino falling onto a lever. And that goes on until it captures a mouse or starts a car or performs some kind of task. Every event triggers the next thing. And Esther's risk-taking is the initial trigger. So 5 verse 2. When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her and held out the golden scepter that was in his hand. Phew. Means he's in a good mood. Probably means he still fancies her. But that's just one very small hurdle cleared. Verse 3. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be given you." Esther says, "Come to this feast." But when he puts her on the spot over dinner, as chapter 5 goes on, what happens? Does she bottle it? She certainly decides to delay, come back to another banquet tomorrow, bring Haman, and at that feast, I'll make known my real request. This is where the action cuts mainly to Haman. So Haman the Agagite, what do we think about him, children? Well done, still alive out there, that's good to see. He's the prime minister, remember, and all these intimate dinners with the royals make him very happy, which they would, wouldn't they? I mean, imagine you get a message from our, you know, King Charles, you know, come and have dinner. You think, what, some big fancy banquet? No, no, just you, me, Camilla. You know, wow, you know, how, what an honour, you know, get to hear what he really thinks about Harry and Meghan, all of that kind of stuff. Great. Well, that's how Haman feels. What an honour for him. But there's always someone who manages to ruin his day. Verse 9. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits, but when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Esther's cousin still not bowing. Urgh! And I know we've legislated to annihilate all the Jews, but... And Haman decides he needs therapy. Did you notice this in 5 verse 11? It's brilliant, therapy. Haman gets together his wife and his friends, and he says, "Guys, it would just really help me feel better if I could talk to you about me for a bit, all the things that I've achieved." And so he boasts about his promotions, his money, his number of sons, which is quite a weird thing to boast to your wife about, isn't it? I mean, she probably knows. B, she probably deserves more credit than he does. And if you're imagining, you know, what a nightmare being married to that, well, she's as much of a nightmare as him. Verse 14, his wife Zeresh and all his friends said, "Have a pole set up reaching to a height of 50 cubits and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it." They clearly met and fell in love at evil school, Haman and his wife. It says a pole, some versions say a gallows. It's basically some kind of execution device that he has set up in the garden. But it makes things very tense at this point in the story, because Haman's off to see the king for permission to have Mordecai hanged. Meanwhile, Esther has delayed in making her request. Is that going to turn out to be a costly delay? It's out of her hands now. But it just so happens, 6 verse 1, we're into chapter 6 now, the king couldn't sleep that night. The NHS says sleeplessness can be caused by stress, underlying health conditions, or alcohol or drug misuse. All of the above could be the issue, from what we know of this guy. And so he asks them to, you see 6 verse 1, bring the book of the record of his reign. It's the same therapy as Haman's therapy. And it just so happens, 6 verse 2, they flick to the page about this time a guy called Mordecai saved the king's life. There's this tiny footnote at the end of the first talk, you maybe didn't even remember it. There was this day when Mordecai uncovered the plot and somebody noted it in a book. And then they all forgot about it. 6 verse 3, what honour and recognition did Mordecai receive for this? The king asked. Nothing has been done for him, the attendants answered. Did we offer him a knighthood or... MBE? Oh, no. And in 6 verse 4, Haman just happened to be in the building. He's come to talk about Mordecai being strung up. King, who never knows what to do, says, bring Haman. He'll know what to do to honour Mordecai. And 6 verse 6 is absolutely brilliant, isn't it? Haman enters. The king asks, what should be done for the man the king delights to honour? And we know about Haman's ego. The king's talking about someone he wants to honour. And I think this is the moment where it's most pantomime in this story. Just imagine Haman, you know, when the baddie comes over and has a little secret chat with the audience. You know, who would the king want to honour more than me? Wink. And verse 7 reveals Haman's heart. Did he spot his fantasy in verse 7? He answered the king, "For the man the king delights to honour, let them bring a royal robe the king has worn, and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head." What's Haman's fantasy? He wants to be the king. But it's all about to go horribly wrong, because great, says the king, let's do all of that for Mordecai the Jew. And Haman comes running back over to the audience, you can imagine, with his hand in his mouth. Ah! And it's brilliant stuff as Haman received not the honour but the shame of having to dress his arch enemy and lead him through the square in the parade. And that's a key moment, because momentum now has swung against the bad guy and his problems rapidly become terminal. End of chapter 6, he's hurried to the banquet where the queen finally tells the king she's a Jew, appeals to him to save her people as she unveils the plotter. 7 verse 5, "Where is he, the man who's dared to do such a thing?" Esther said, "An adversary, an enemy, this vile Haman." Da da da. The king storms out onto the balcony. An irreversible edict has been made. How's he going to get round this one? And he walks back in at just the moment from where he's standing. It looks as if Haman is assaulting the queen. That in itself is grounds for instant dismissal. And 7 verse 9, this Harbona character, I think, must have been the class telltale. You know, sir, he's actually got a gallows in his own garden, you know, if it's helpful for you to know. And in terms of the tension of the whole book, that's really the end of the story. We know it's all going to be okay for Esther and her people now. 7 verse 10, the impaled Haman. 8 verse 1, that same day King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he'd reclaimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. And that, children, is how it happened. There just happened to be a gallows. And there just happened to be a sleepless king. And the king just happened to walk in at the right moment. And there just happened to be a queen who just happened to be in position. And she just so happened to be from the same people group of the people who just so happened to find themselves being delivered from destruction. It's a great story, isn't it? How are we getting to know God better, though? That's the thing. Are we right to say we can learn anything about God from this book where his name is never mentioned? Well, I think it's the text itself that drives us to look for a higher power. So they literally roll the dice to decide their government business. That seems to be an invitation to question who or what really determines outcomes. Deliverance will arise. That suggestive comment, without taking us to anywhere particular in the Old Testament. And here's another suggestive comment. I skimmed over it. 6 verse 13. Haman's wife, 6 verse 13. She might be Cruella de Vil, but she's spot on theologically. 6 verse 13. "Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you can't stand against him. You will surely come to ruin." Of Jewish origin. If you mess with those people, you're going to be in trouble. To which Haman might have said to her, "Well, thanks very much. You might have told me before now." She's right. Still no explicit quotes. It's making us do the work deliberately. But every time they're mentioned, 40 times in Esther, the Jewish people, it's a reminder that these are not just any people. Are there covenants connected with them and a track record about the Jewish people? We've got to do the work ourselves, remember what we know into the situation. So let me make a general observation first. I've written down the word providence there. Theologians talk about providence. That's the ongoing relationship of God to the world he has made. And providence emphasises not just his sovereign hand, but his good, purposeful involvement in all the details of our world. So if God's behind this rise and fall, how many details does that mean he's in control of here? Well, the king's drunkenness that then he sacked his original wife, God's in charge of how good-looking Esther was and the king's liking of her. He's in control of the outcomes of all of Esther and Mordecai's decisions, whether dubious or brave. He's in charge of the plan to build that gallows. God was behind the king's sleeplessness that night, and which page of the book they flipped to. And God somehow in charge of the exact moment and the exact angle that the king was standing at when he walked back in the room, and a whole bunch of other stuff as well. His name is never mentioned. And that's deliberate, because it's how life feels in exile. We don't get a running commentary of exactly how Gaza or Ukraine plays into the Lord's purposes. But when you plug what you're seeing here into the rest of the Bible, a lot is cast into the lap, but every decision from the Lord, Proverbs 16. The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he will, Proverbs 21. Genesis 50, Joseph to his brothers, you meant it for harm against me, but the Lord meant this for good. And I know that digs up a whole load of questions about sovereignty, about God's relationship with evil. The Bible's really clear, God never directly causes evil or sin or takes pleasure in them. But if it blows your mind a bit thinking about how God's involvement in the world engages with our involvement, then good, it should. The omniscient mind of God and a whole tapestry of interconnected events that in the middle of the story, well, we could never possibly work out how they all weave together and how he's using them. But we can be sure he is using them. We sometimes find God's sovereignty offensive, don't we, in our generation. And some of the reasons aren't maybe cultural, to do with the level of control and freedom we've been expected to enjoy over our lives. You know, God's rule over history is actually meant to be a pastoral comfort. That's always how it's presented in the Bible. And I think it'd be a real shame if this doctrine that's meant to be for our comfort actually saps the joy out of the gospel in our generation. You will need strong beliefs about God's providence as you go through life, as you together go through the highs and lows of church life. You'll need strong beliefs that in all things, he is at work in good ways for the ultimate deliverance of his people. I was just remembering, Rue was asking about the sort of history of Euston Church. Before we were in our current church building, the cathedral that Rue likes, we used to meet in the lecture room. It was a bit like this. It was in UCL. We got reported to the university once. Someone had said that I was a hate preacher. And that was quite troubling for us, because the venue really mattered to us at that time. We couldn't really see where else we could be. None of that was outside the providence of God. And at that time, when we were worrying about where we would meet physically in venues, we never imagined a time when we wouldn't be able to meet physically as a church. COVID, real challenges for the churches during that time, wasn't it? None of it outside the providence of God. And then deliverance will rise. That's the specific angle on his providence that means we need the book of Esther. It's wonderful, because it means if you've got a God who's fully invested in you relationally and fully in control of events, nothing can stop you in that way, as the Bible and church history since then testifies too. Esther's so precious because it says that God's not only at work for the good of his people when he's visibly boshing the pharaohs, he's at work when he goes unnoticed and unmentioned by the powers that be. Esther says he's at work in the coincidences, the mundane, the decisions of powerful people who think that they write history. And he's even at work through the dubious choices of his children. And I want to be careful how I say that. Not at all to justify the making of dubious choices, see rest of the Bible. It's just that don't assume you'll ever be able to make a single decision, good, bad, indifferent, reckless, or have such a compromised track record in your past that God will not be using all of that towards his deliverance plan. He is bigger than it all. And I don't know about you, But I am so relieved that he is bigger than all the choices and decisions that I've made in my life. Big God. And so, finally, then, point three, how will this shape the way you see the world as you head back home this afternoon and head to work or wherever tomorrow morning? Can I recommend ditching a few isms? Now, atheism, just because you've got an explanation for cause and effect, doesn't mean that God's not directing everything. I think we Christians can function as atheists sometimes, can't we, when we forget to thank him for the details. Now, polytheism, it's not that he's God in Jerusalem, but others are God in Persia. No dualism, no battle of equals between good and evil. The evil is actually all being used by God towards his end. No deism, you know, that's the God who winds up the clock and lets it run. No fatalism and no randomism. Random is not an ism. No randomness in the world. And all of that's to say, don't make big distinctions between natural and supernatural events. Or talk about secular spaces as if they're not all his spaces. Or speak about divine intervention or God moments as if they're not all God moments. Don't think about his big plan as if that's totally disconnected from the details and the working out. I mentioned North Korea. So for folks there in those prison camps this weekend, look at the guards. Every mood, every neuron of their brain, every executive order or of every prison governor under the government of God. And then your life, your supervisor, the mood they're in when you see them this week, what happened to them, that maybe that's them on the phone, there you go, your supervisor. What happened to them this weekend that will knock on to you, something that gets decided tomorrow that impacts you, all under his government. When people seem to be the masters, when they don't tolerate the gospel, and when you're worried that being a bolder Christian will be a dangerous thing, well, who do we think is running this show? Don't think that because lots of people in Britain have stopped talking about him that God's plan won't be achieved. Do you think he suddenly changed his mind about his precious children? It's story arc resolution here in Esther, but we still live in the middle of our story, though we know the ending. And there's no suspense about how it will end for us, so sorry if you like a good cliffhanger. This is absolute spoiler alert. Your ending is this. You will spend all eternity, that's longer than 180 days, all eternity delighting in the greatness of the real king who only ever loves to serve his bride. You're heading for the king's feast, people of God. That's your ending. So keep being the different ones. You're no fool to trust him during your time of exile. Shall we pray? Oh, the depth of the riches, the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who's known the mind of the Lord? Or who's been his counsellor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay them? For from him and through him and for him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen. Amen.